Good morning. It's great to see everyone. Someone in the choir asked me how I was feeling, and I said, I feel like a kid on the first day of school. I love Homecoming Sunday. It's really great to see everyone. And this morning, we're beginning our month-long look at the theme of kinship. And as with all of our themes, when you first start to look at them, you think, kinship, I got that, I know that. But then when you go deeper, when you really sink down into the deepest possible meaning of the word, you begin to wonder, who are my kin? Who am I really related to, and are all of those people human? And how, once I figure out who my kin are, how might I treat those people that are my kin, those beings that are my kin? How does one be a good member of the family, so to speak? And so we begin our look at what it means to be a part of the family of things, as poet Mary Oliver said. And I begin that by inviting some of our beloved kin, Philip and Maria, to come forward to light our chalice this morning. I think when many of us think of how we are looked after as kin, we might think of Maria's shortbread cookies or Philip's Indian curry, or some of the many ways in which they have been kin, have become kin to those of us in this community. And so it feels fitting to have them kindle the flame this morning.
Are there any other children or youth who would like to join us at the front for a story? Oh, nice to see you, Luke. A few more coming, Desmond and Lucas and Tobin. Hi, Jenny. And Emma, nice to see you. So you might have noticed on the order of service, or for adults in emails, an image, a nice image of elephants. Tail to trunk, trunk to tail, hanging on to each other like real kin. That's right. But you know, that's right. Families are kin. But sometimes it doesn't work out quite like that. The king had only one elephant, so he lived alone. He lived alone in a very beautiful stable. The walls were made of marble and they were all inlaid. And the bedding that was provided to the elephant was of the finest quality thatch. And if that elephant ever had the least bit of an itch, his mahout, his caregiver, would take him down to the river for a roll in the mud and a scrub and a bathe in the water. A nice spa, really. And when he was hungry, well, he had the freshest cabbages and bananas delivered, other vegetables, sweet rice, and always at the end of the meal, an elephant-sized sugar cube. It sounds like he had a nice life, and, well, he tried to appreciate it, but truth be told, he spent a lot of the time in his stable kind of rocking back and forth the way elephants do, a little bit bored and lonely. Meanwhile, just outside the stable, there was a dog, a skinny, scrawny dog. He was alone too. He spent most of his time lurking in the shadows, trying not to be seen, but he did have one pleasure. And that was when he saw the mahout arrive with all that food. He'd go up under the window of the stable and just breathe in the smells of the fresh cabbages and bananas, the fresh oranges and acacia leaves, the sweet, sweet rice, and the sugar cube. Sometimes he almost felt like he'd eaten. One day, the stable door was left ajar. Just enough for a skinny, scrawny dog to get in. He was scared. What would that great big elephant do? But the elephant didn't seem to notice. Not at all. didn't notice, but the dog noticed. The dog noticed how many crumbs the elephant spilled when he was eating. He plucked up his courage and scurried underneath that great big elephant and began to eat those crumbs. He couldn't stop till the floor was clean, and then he hurried back into the shadows. Still, the elephant paid no attention. And so the dog slept there in the shadows that night, and the next day, same thing. When the food arrived, well, you know, it seemed like the elephant spilled even more crumbs. So the dog had more to eat that day. And so it went for several days, and the dog slowly got healthier and livelier. And finally, when the dog himself was feeling fully restored, well, that's the day the elephant noticed him. But he wasn't angry. Far from it. He took his trunk and he gave that dog a big hug. And after that, the elephant and the dog slept side by side, and they ate side by side, and they began to share stories. It was a wonderful time, and maybe it would have gone on forever, except that the mahout was down in the village square, and he heard about a merchant who was looking to buy a dog. And the mahout thought, that stray dog, no one will mind. He's fed up nicely. I could sell him and earn a few coins for my family. So he took that dog by a leash and he dragged him down to the village square. The merchant saw what a fine-looking dog he was, and he paid good money for that dog. And then he had to drag the dog too all the way home. After that, the elephant seemed to lose all interest in food. He stopped eating. He wouldn't go down to the river even for a spa. Imagine that. He just lay on his stable floor, listless. Word of this spread to the king. When he asked the mahout didn't know. So he called on one of his advisors who specialized in animal welfare, who took the elephant's temperature and his pulse. He looked in his ears and his throat. There's nothing wrong with this elephant. And then he looked in the elephant's eyes. This elephant is grieving. Oh, well, maybe it's that dog, said the mahout. The dog is so little. I don't know where the merchant lives, said the mahout when he was asked a little more. But the king issued a proclamation. Whoever bought a dog from the royal stables, return it at once. It took a few hours, but when the merchant heard this proclamation, he was quite happy to oblige. That dog had whined incessantly. As soon as he released him, that dog went racing back to the stables. Oh, the elephant gave him a great big elephant hug. Clearly, having his new kin back was the best medicine, the only medicine that elephant needed. Just like the medicine we're all having today. Gathered together. Let us form the arches and we'll head out.
So much can be contained in one life, in one day. I want to begin the meditation by sharing some sad news that I just learned this morning. For those of you who were at the regional fall gathering that we hosted here for Unitarians from all over this area, you'll remember we had a guest, a longtime Unitarian from Winnipeg, Don Bailey, who was selling his books. And I just found out that Don passed away just a day or so ago. I got an email from the minister in Winnipeg this morning saying that Don has left us. And so I share that news with a heavy heart. I certainly enjoyed all of my interactions with him, picking up his books and things when he was here, and just a sweet, delightful man. So let's begin our meditation time for those of us who know him with just a moment of silence for him, and then I'll share a prayer. Spirit of life and of love, Spirit of breath and of heartbeat, of being and presence. We're mindful and aware this morning of how our lives are both singular and unique, small and large, that even in the small circles of our daily routines, our lives have an impact. We know that our own fears, our own griefs, our own losses and loves are connected and draw us into that larger web of life. We're aware as well this morning that so many in the web are hurting. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people without homes and food in our own community and all over Europe, in Afghanistan, and in so many nations around the world. And our prayer this morning is that someday we might see our web so clearly, know our connectedness so deeply, that every person, that all beings in the web of life might have a home which is safe, a home which is loving, a home in which to become. For all of these prayers on our hearts, and for all of the individual worries and cares and loves that we have brought with us this morning, we pause both in gratitude, in hope, and in prayer. So may it be. And amen.
My story this morning is about how a little boy and a big tree taught me a lesson about connection. Ancient trees, our old-growth forests, always remind me of time going by. Seasons, years, lifetimes. 500 or 600 years may go by, and they grow, and they grow, and they see so many of us come and go and come and go. They feel to me like ancestors across time and space. They were here long before us, and many of them will outlive us. This summer, I was graced with an understanding, if ever so brief, as those things usually go, of the deep connection between our species. On Denman Island, where is our family home and where I spend most of my summers, and many of you have visited me there, we have a couple of very small but still protected old-growth forests. One, called Falongli Park, is beloved by most of our islanders and certainly by four generations now of my family. The last true walk outside my father took was along the fern-shrouded creek, and he rested on a stump beneath one of the ancient firs. My grandchildren now play on that stump. My kids loved these big trees. They called them aunties and uncles. They would lean against a knobbled trunk or pat them on their way by to see or see how far around their arms could go
When they were little, it took three of them, arm to arm, to make their way around the biggest tree. They were family in a different skin, with whom they visited and hugged. One day this summer, I walked there for the first time alone with my 19-month-old grandson. He's been in Africa since he was born, so he has never seen big trees. He's very verbal and into naming everything he sees. We said hi to many big trees. As we passed our favorite tree along the lower path, we stopped and looked up. I was suddenly struck by the fact that this tree has now seen these four generations of my family, and if we are lucky and care better for this earth, may see many more. I suddenly wanted to honor that connection, introduce my grandson to this other kind of auntie, so I put my hand on the tree and the other on my heart, and I said, "Hello, big tree. This is my grandson, Kyler." Kyler went still. He looked at me, and then he looked up at the tree. Then he came over, put his hand on the tree, and gestured towards the dog and I. "Amma," he said, and then looked at the tree. "Sasha," he said, and then looked at the tree, and then he patted his own heart. And so he greeted this new kin, clearly introducing the tree to his grandmother and his dog, and then himself. He stood still for another moment, then patted the tree once more. In that small, amazing moment, something shifted in me, realigned for even an infinitesimal time to an infinite and wondrous truth. We truly are all interconnected. That beloved little boy and the beloved tree and the air and the water and the earth, which nourishes us all? Of course we are a family, different but united, related by the blood of our distant stardust kin. Kyler's immediate acceptance of this tree as a being with whom he was in relationship did not come from his head. He didn't figure it out. The knowing existed already. He simply saw it with his heart and soul. He accepted the interbeing of himself and the big tree as a given, and he was happy for it. Luckily for me and for many of us, there are little ones around to help us remember what we know, to see the truth of interbeing with simple joy. May it always be so. This morning, we'll begin with two readings. The first from the Hebrew Bible, from the book of Genesis, one of my personal favorites. One of the early accounts of a human being trying to discern what it means to be in relationship, the responsibility that comes with connection. You know it as the story of Cain and Abel. Genesis chapter 4, verses 3 through 10. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel, for his part, brought of the firstlings of his flock their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let us go out to the field." And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. The second reading is from renowned African-American poet Gwendolyn Brooks. A line from her that I read every time a colleague sends me an email because it is the signature of her messages to me. We are each other's harvest. We are each other's business. We are each other's magnitude and bond. Kingdom come. Every Sunday that I went to my grandparents' Methodist church when I was young, we said the Lord's Prayer. I became so accustomed to the words that even this Unitarian had those words roll right off my tongue every single time. And there was a certain comfort to it, the shared language of recitation, the request for help. But I never liked the vision of the kingdom. Your kingdom come. Always felt like asking God to somehow or some way overlay a God world by force or by will or by miracle on top of the only world and life I knew and I know. Your kingdom come felt a little bit to me like asking for God as despot. I will make the world better, just you watch, children. But would that actually be better? A world that required such intervention would surely indicate that all had been lost. Would salvation by force feel like salvation at all? There's a woman that I consider a mentor, a sort of ministerial role model for me. I guess for me, she's kind of like a rock star. So, you know, teenagers today like Taylor Swift, I like Jackie Lewis. You know. And she reframed and reimagined for me this whole notion of kingdom. She speaks of God's kingdom. And as soon as she said, we're trying to create kingdom on earth, I immediately set off on a different path. The image of a kingdom works for me. A kingdom would be a place where peace would prevail, where respect for differences and appreciation of diversity of every variety would be commonplace. A kingdom would be that idyllic place that we envision when we imagine a world without violence or hatred. Yeah, I can get behind a kingdom. And any vision of God worth its salt is a God who can as well, who is actively rooting for such a place to come into being. It is that God who said to Cain, why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. I love those lines. See, God's calling right now. I like those lines from God because it seems to me that God's saying, just because something doesn't go your way doesn't mean you can get angry and lash out. The temptation to get angry and to lash out will always be there, but you must master it. Your countenance need not fall. Your anger need not get the best of you, God seems to be saying. We are still, my friends, and continually seeking to do well and must indeed work to master those moments when we are drawn toward blame and shame and lashing out or leading with where we misunderstand one another rather than seeking common connection. Now, Cain, of course, had it wrong. And not just because he killed his brother. That was pretty horrific. But it seems to me that he was asking the wrong question when he said, "Am I my brother's keeper?" You can almost picture that, him like with this, you know, sarcastic talking back. The guy like, "What? I don't know where my brother is. What, am I my brother's keeper?" Some translations from the Hebrew suggest that the word isn't keeper, but rather guardian. As if Cain saying, "What, am I supposed to be looking after my brother every day of the week, every hour of every day? I'm not his guardian. I'm not his protector. I'm not his keeper." But what if he had instead thought, along with Gwendolyn Brooks, that his brother was his harvest? Particularly appropriate since he was a farmer. What if his brother was his business, his harvest, his magnitude, and his bond? What then? Wouldn't jealousy seem even more petty? Wouldn't Abel's well-being and health be not only a yardstick by which he might compare his success vocationally, which seems to me to be missing the point, but a yardstick for how he's doing as a person? How's my brother doing? And if he's doing well, what does that say about me? And if he's struggling, what does that say about me and my brotherness, my brotherhood, how well I am being a brother? We are not one another's keepers. And as much as the parent in me would like to be a guardian, I recognize I'm not that either. We never have been keepers or guardians of one another. But how well others are doing and how well we are living out our hopes and vision, rather than our fears and our anger, that very much matters. If we are each other's magnitude and bond, then we will have to look bad occasionally, it seems to me. We will have to take in migrants that inconvenience us. We will have to look at the racism and other biases that we carry in our being. We will have to do what we can to, in short, make the suffering of others unacceptable. We have become, it seems to me, ever more aware of the fact that a kingdom, as Leslie's story so beautifully illustrated, isn't just about us humans either. All living things are kin. We are but one species in this interconnected whole that we are a part of. Part of being kin, the meaning of kinship, taking that seriously, means that we have to be intentional in how we live out our connection. It means seeing kin in its broadest possible terms. The dictionary definition of kin says not just that kin is family, but that kin are our relations. And relations is pretty broad. You can be related to just about anything and anyone. In fact, it's harder to not be related than it is to be related, isn't it? Our relatedness is so much bigger and broader than family and human. It's ancestors we never met. It's plants we pass by each day and animals. It's the whole web of life. If I see myself as connected in this way, it is nearly impossible for me to do anything that might damage the web or break ties without seeing that I am severing a part of my own life, a part of my own chance at wholeness. When I see myself as not an isolated being with a private story, with a life that I get to create on my own and hold just for me. When I see myself as part of a stream of life that flows through me and around me, wow, do things change. Then I see that I came from somewhere, that I came from someone's, that I am not here by my own power, that anchors me. I come from somewhere, from some people. I am part of a tribe, if you will. That anchors me. And then from that anchored place, I can see the current connections to my life and envision the ripples that flow out from there. I suppose if we're really blunt, if we're really honest with ourselves, we realize that caring about our kin is not simply or wholly altruistic. We like to think, oh, I'm caring about these people. Aren't I a good person? It reflects so well on me. And yet, really, when we're caring about other people, there is something in it for me. That something is a more livable planet and more habitable relationships for everyone, not just me. I'm not very interested, and never have been, in a kingdom. But I'm desperate for a kingdom. A planet Earth in which every living thing knows that the ties between us are real. That the harm that any of us does, the hurt that any of us causes, has impact beyond the immediate place and being involved. We just passed September 11th, did we not? A reminder that our actions have power, that we can do harm, that when people feel severed from the web of life, they will lash out, much like Cain. They will run planes into buildings. They will take lives and not care because they think no one cares about their lives, that the web does not include them anymore. And we see that reminder every time we look at images of those scared and displaced refugees, the Syrians and the Afghanis who are pouring into Europe. And so this week I sat in my office and I looked over at the words of William Ellery Channing from 1830, and one of my ancestors once again reminded me of this web of life and how important my role is in it. In 1830, Channing wrote and said, "I am a living member of the great family of all souls. I can hardly perform an act that is confined in its consequences to myself. Others are affected by what I am and say and do, so that a single act of mine may spread and spread in widening circles through a nation or humanity." 1830, he wrote that. It matters what we do. It matters who we include in our circle of kin and care. May we be open to seeing one another as each other's harvest, as each other's business, as each other's magnitude and bond, and not just the human ones of us, too. May we be open to expanding that circle of kinship so that our influence the ripples flowing out from us is to the good of us all. Kingdom come. The beautiful poetry of Brian Wren. I asked you before if you heard what you sing, and you said no. So I'm going to remind you what you just sang. We are not our own. Earth forms us.